promise this would not happen during the conference. Malik tried to wangle some indication it would at least not happen as a surprise right after they convened, but Jessup held firm. A commitment was beyond his authority. They broke off again. Bevan, frustrated, was convinced the Soviets would, irrespective of Jessup's protestations, hold the Allies morally committed not to move on Germany while a conference were in session. Acheson, however, remained untroubled, insisting that Soviet desires would not affect the tempo of Allied efforts to build West Germany. The two were now deadlocked on tactics, with Acheson wanting Jessup to push for Soviet commitments and Bevan wanting to ignore Malik and push the pace of the Bonn talks. With the Malik-Jessup channel stalled, Stalin chose, as Acheson expected he would, to go public. On April 26, TASS issued a communique summarizing the secret talks. The agency reported that mutual trade and communications restrictions in Berlin would be lifted prior to a meeting of the four foreign ministers, if a date for such a meeting could be set. Simultaneous with the TASS publication, new Soviet technology jammed all Russian-language Voice of America programming. Following a hastily arranged meeting between Jessup and Malik the following day, at which the two sparred over details of the blockade rollbacks and CFM agenda, Jessup emerged onto Park Avenue to face a crush of reporters and flashing cameras. Taking text from his pocket written by Bolin in anticipation of the Soviet leaks, he announced that preparations for the creation of the new Federal Republic of Germany would continue uninterrupted. He added, however, that the Allies would continue in their sincere endeavor to reach a new four-power agreement, an endeavor Acheson had long since abandoned. In the coming week, the Soviets would continue to press for delay of the foreign ministers' meeting until late June, taking advantage of Jessup's private assurances that no West German state would come to be before it convened. While Bevan fretted about Soviet traps, Acheson remained insouciant. The CFM, for him, had no more significance than he was willing to give it. The Soviets could haggle and harangue. The Allies needed only to bear it and run out the clock. Acheson prevailed. On May 4th, Jessup, together with British Ambassador Alexander Cadogan and French Ambassador Jean Chauvel, reached an agreement with Malik to end both sides' German trade and communications restrictions on May 12th, and to convene a CFM conference in Paris on May 23rd. They issued a communique the following day. The airlift had survived the worst nature could throw at it. Despite snow and high winds, March 1949 saw a record daily average of 6,300 tons, 1,500 tons more than forecast. April's average then climbed to 7,850 tons, with coal deliveries exceeding their target by 50%. And to show the world what the Allies were capable of, Tonner organized a Herculean 24-hour coal lift starting at noon on April 15th that delivered 12,941 tons, with 1,398 planes, landing nearly 1 a minute. On May 11th, Acheson gave a press conference hailing the great morale, great discipline, and superb courage of those who had made the airlift possible. They had carried out an astounding 277,804 relief flights, delivering 2,325,809 tons of food, coal, and other supplies. It had not, however, solved the German problem, Acheson stressed. Whether a solution can be reached depends upon the willingness of the Russians to make or consider proposals which will not retard the great progress which has been made by the Western powers in their effort to bring as much of Germany as possible into a condition where it can be a peaceful and constructive member of the community of free nations in Europe. That community, he said, was being built around the Marshall Plan. The message was clear. The only acceptable alternative to a West Germany in the ERP was a united Germany in the ERP. The United States would never permit the Soviet Union to communize the country, a mirror image of Stalin's determination never to relinquish control in the East. That night, electricity from Soviet sector plants began flowing into West Berlin. Just after midnight, a U.S. Army vehicle headed west out of Berlin onto the Autobahn in eastern Germany, and a British vehicle headed through the Helmstedt Soviet checkpoint toward Berlin. A passenger train from Western Germany entered the Soviet zone, the first in over a year, arriving in Berlin at 5:11 a.m. on May 12th. Huge crowds celebrated. The blockade, or at least the most visible manifestations of it, was over. Feeling his job complete, Clay resigned and headed home 3 days later. That no Soviet preconditions applied to the blockade's lifting underlined the Western triumph. The blockade had ended, Acheson said, because the Russians themselves decided it was unsuccessful. This was a vindication of Kennan's position that the Kremlin could recognize situations, if not arguments. "We are asking ourselves," he wrote in a self-satisfied memo to Webb, "whether it could be that the fortunes of the Cold War have shifted so dramatically in the past 2 years that it is now the Russians who are trying to follow, with regard to us, a policy of firmness and patience and unprovocative containment." Still, the Soviets maintained whatever barriers they could without triggering an American pullout from the coming CFM conference. The Soviets, Clay's acting successor James Riddleberger cabled Acheson on May 19th, have now returned to their well-known tactics of slanted interpretation. Berlin remains today in a state of semi-blockade. Clay had foreseen this, having earlier warned against a premature wind-down of airlift capacity. "The blockade was broken by air power," he had cabled Washington on May 1st, "and the air power should be maintained in full until the Council of Foreign Ministers has completed its deliberations. It would in fact be maintained until September 30th. For their part, the Soviets considered the restrictions justified on two grounds. First, they had expected the Allies to liberalize trade policy broadly, which would bring needed goods to the Soviet bloc and permit a revival of Moscow's reparations policy. The Allies, however, imposed export licensing and currency clearing requirements that, the Soviets insisted, violated commitments they had made in New York. Second, reports from Bonn suggested formation of a West German government was imminent, which meant that the CFM conference would not hinder it. They therefore saw no reason to be more cooperative than was necessary, to prevent a withdrawal of Allied concessions. Stalin had launched the blockade as leverage in Germany, yet it had not rolled back the Deutschmark. It had not stopped progress toward a West German state. It had not stopped creation of a North Atlantic Defense Pact. Oddly, the greatest threat to these objectives had come from George Kennan. Back in late 1948, with the Allies advancing their plans for a German Federal Republic and a military alliance, Kennan began raising awkwardly timed questions as to whether these were even sensible constructs. It was, he argued, flawed strategic thinking to freeze the conflict in Europe, with Russian troops 100 miles from Hamburg. East-West confrontation in Berlin could flare at any moment. Furthermore, partitioning Germany was more likely to fuel nationalist passions than it was to assist integration of the Western half into Europe. The only way to end the struggle with the Soviets over Germany, and ultimately to induce them to leave Central and Eastern Europe, was to unify the country and withdraw all occupation forces. Effectively, Kennan and Clay had swapped positions between 1947 and 1949. Kennan, who had earlier backed German partition, arguing that the idea of a Germany run jointly with the Russians is a chimera, and that we have no choice but to lead our section to a form of independence, had now become the leading advocate of German neutrality and unity. A study mission to Germany in March 1949, in which he witnessed firsthand the destruction of the war, convinced him that the continued occupation could only lead to a renewed conflagration. Incredibly, the same policies of mutual withdrawal and reunification had been advocated by Lippmann in his 1947 pieces attacking Kennan's Mr. X article. For his part, Clay, who had earlier opposed partition and moves to end cooperation with Moscow and Germany, had become the leading advocate of Allied zone secession and integration with the West. Talks with Kennan in Berlin disturbed him. He feared that Kennan's new position suggested a lack of determination in Washington to complete formation of a West German government. Marshall decided only to hand off Program A, as Kennan's plan became known, to his successor Acheson, who had never been part of the London program planning and had no stake in it. Acheson told aides he knew little about Germany and was initially intrigued by Kennan's case. Convinced, like Kennan, that an indefinite occupation of Germany was untenable, he felt it sensible to subject the plan to scrutiny. He thought it might even form the basis of a U.S. proposal within the CFM, if only to smoke the Soviets out and force them to state openly their intentions to dominate Germany. He even wondered aloud how a West German government had become U.S. policy. Had it simply been the brainchild of General Clay? For his part, Clay rounded on Program A. "It would be suicidal to our objectives," he said. "The Russians would cheat, the French would panic, and the Germans would go communist, militarist, or both. It would also require a root and branch rethinking of the Marshall Plan. It was very difficult to operate a single economy without a central West German government," Clay said of American aims in the country, "and withdrawing U.S. forces would be turning the show over to Russia and the communists without a struggle." The defense secretary and the joint chiefs of staff united behind him, stressing the dangers of moving American troops 3,000 miles westward, while Soviet troops moved only a few hundred to the east. Before Jessup and Boland could carry out confidential briefings for the French and British in early May, however, journalist James Reston published a crude version of the leaked plan in the New York Times. "United States, British, and French troops now standing between the Soviet army and Western Europe would be withdrawn to the area of the North German ports." Bevin and Schumann were blindsided, thinking they were up against a change in U.S. policy just weeks after the launch of the North Atlantic Pact. Acheson tried to assure them the plan was Kennan's alone, and not a trial balloon of the U.S. government. And in an off-the-record briefing for American reporters on May 18, 1949, he buried it. "We will not agree to the withdrawal of occupation troops," he told them. "One would make a grave error to think that any agreement with the Russians on withdrawal would mean anything." Whereas he continued to support the unification of the German people, or as large a part of them as may prove practicable, his priority was buttressing Western Europe against Soviet pressure. Germany was a means to this end. If united Germany contributes to that aim, fine. If not, to hell with it. To Kennan's lament, Acheson was now pushing Kennan's early containment ideas into the realm of offense. Lippmann had been critical of containment on the grounds that it allowed the Soviets to choose the battlefield. Acheson also saw this flaw and was determined to challenge Moscow on every front, political, economic, and military, after first creating situations of strength. The United States would, he believed, win the Cold War not through incessant repulsing of Soviet advances, but through demonstration of superior capability and will. But it was not just the three Allied governments that rejected Kennan's German unity plan. West German leaders themselves would have no truck with it. Both Adenauer and SPD Chairman Schumacher insisted that their countrymen, having had long experience of totalitarian methods, would never accept Russian terms for unification or even withdrawal of Western troops. The Soviets would continue to champion unification and withdrawal of occupation forces for propaganda purposes, but they too rejected Kennan's ideas in practice. "Those who think we should remove our troops," Chukov told Bolin after being briefed on the plan, "don't understand that the Germans hate us. We must, as a matter of national security," he insisted, "maintain our forces in Germany." The shredding of Program A marked the beginning of the end of Kennan's frontline role in the shaping of post-war Europe. His proposal's morose, rambling defeatism had stood out in sharp contrast to the bold confidence of Mr. X. Moods colored his analysis, and his current one reflected discomfort with the mainstreaming of his once provocative ideas. Faced with a need for action, as in the Berlin crisis, he tended to brood, seek inspiration in Gibbon, and indulge his distrust of convention, even when that convention was his own creation. Like Kennan, Acheson had a fine mind, but a practical one, not a ruminative or emotional one. Confronted with a problem, he would insist that, "if you can't do anything about it, just stop thinking about it," recalled his daughter Mary. Get on with something. Though Kennan's office continued to adjoin the Secretary of State's, he would lose the access he had under Marshall. Acheson dismissed criminologists like Kennan as dangerous soothsayers pushing uncommunicable guesses that must be accepted by those who have not the same occult power of divination. He ordered that policy planning staff director memos should go to the assistant secretaries rather than to himself personally. Thus, seeing his influence wane toward irrelevance, feeling at times like a court jester, Kennan would, in December 1949, choose to depart from the think tank he had fathered at State. Under his successor, the less cerebral but more fashionably hawkish Paul Nitze, PPS would be more tank and less think. The Council of Foreign Ministers reconvened in Paris after an 18-month hiatus on May 23, 1949. For the Soviets, the talks commenced on the worst possible note. The Bonn Parliamentary Council approved the new West German constitution, blandly called the Basic Law, Grundgesetz, to highlight its provisional status while Germany remained divided, on May 8th. Accepted by the Allies on May 12th and quickly ratified by the Trizonal Lande, it now came into force on the same day the four powers began deliberations, deliberations Moscow had demanded to prevent its creation. It was Vyshinsky's first major diplomatic failure. Still, Adenauer worried. Let us be under no serious illusions, he told the Bonn Council in his closing speech. This Paris conference might have very serious consequences for us. We do not want conditions in the Western zones to converge toward those in the Eastern zone as a result of the negotiations. State Department position papers for the conference stressed that Western Germany was essential to the success of the European recovery program, but noted that Moscow aimed to keep the country isolated and prevent integration of Western Europe under U.S. leadership. For Acheson, however, West Germany was non-negotiable. We are making progress with the integration of Germany into a free and democratic Europe, he told Douglas, and we shall not jeopardize this in Paris. With Acheson determined not to make concessions, the conference quickly stalemated when Vyshinsky called for a return to four-power control and a Soviet veto. Acheson dismissed the proposal as back to Potsdam. The Allies, he said, would never return to a system that had failed so disastrously. The Soviet zone was in a state of economic collapse. Shackling West Germany's recovery to the tottering East was, he said, like asking a paralyzed person who was three-quarters recovered to go back to complete paralysis. Vyshinsky struggled to break down Acheson's resolute indifference. It was beyond his skills to camouflage Russia's fraying position in Germany. That position had become precarious in December, following the anti-communist electoral rout in Berlin, and weaker still with the collapse of the blockade. To Acheson's claim that Western Zone industrial production had reached 90% of 1936 levels, Vyshinsky reported that it was now 96.6% in the East. The Allied delegates guffawed. I will certainly see, Bevan said, smiling, that the refugees learned about the paradise which they had left. If the Allies were going to consider Soviet proposals, Acheson concluded, Vyshinsky needed to make himself clear on the substance of what he wanted to achieve in Germany. Otherwise, this question of control was an idle discussion. Schumann called it building a roof without constructing walls. Acheson had previewed his Paris strategy in his candid May 18th briefing. If the conference was to be another Russian propaganda episode in the Cold War, he told the reporters, we too will play that game to the hilt. He would tolerate 4 weeks at most. At that point, we will pack up our marbles and come home. The Russians, he said, called this conference as a face-saver for the bankruptcy of their policy in Eastern Germany. But we have 45 million Germans behind us who are not going to let communist stooges in Eastern Germany dominate them. The United States would go ahead with the establishment of a Western German government, come hell or high water. Any unification must be on the basis of the Bonn Constitution. The Allies presented this blueprint to Vyshinsky on May 30th. It was audacious to the point of provocation, not so much an offer as a surrender demand. They proposed to extend the bond constitution countrywide, terminate reparations, establish economic unity on the basis of one currency, free trade, and dissolution of Soviet corporations, and create a new elected German government under four-power supervisory control with majority rule. No Soviet veto. Acheson braced for Vyshinsky's explosion, but the Russian stayed calm. He merely chided the Allies for advance agreement on a plan which gave the impression of fait accompli. Though it seemed hardly a suitable document for quadripartite agreement, he said he would study it. Reading the proposal in Moscow, Stalin, however, was not calm. He was livid. Did Vyshinsky not recognize an insult or even a threat? "It looks as if you don't quite understand," Stalin cabled him, "that the three powers proposal boils down to their intent to merge the eastern zone with the western ones on their own terms. They want to swallow our zone and to tie us to their chariot in Germany, depriving us of those rights to reparations which we received in Potsdam. It was," he said, "absolutely unacceptable." Following the lashing from Stalin, Vyshinsky uncorked his old form. In Nitz's words, he turned extreme, assertive, and nasty. He denounced the Allied plan as undemocratic and a blatant contravention of Potsdam, which was itself, of course, undemocratic. He called the Bonn Constitution a secret document dictated by the West and designed to dismember rather than unite Germany. Majority rule in the Allied Control Council was, he said, itself dictatorial. The Soviet Union would never subordinate itself to the rule of the majority. As for reparations, the Allies had no grounds for conflating it with the issue of economic unity. And the proposal to dismantle Soviet companies merely aimed at imposing American and British monopolistic capitalism and to take over all of German industry. This imperialism, he said, was the essence of the Marshall Plan. Sitting restless hour after hour, day after day, in the musical comedy setting of the Hotel Talleyrand Perigord's Palais de Marbre Rose, Acheson felt himself driven to the limits of human endurance by Vyshinsky's dialectics. Bevin, for his part, took a more relaxed approach, often napping through them. In the 3 weeks that followed, no progress was made on German unity. Only cosmetic wording on future cooperation could be agreed. Intense debate over Austria, however, which was divided into occupation zones like Germany, led to a deal through which the Soviets traded away reparations claims, as well as support for Yugoslav territorial and financial claims, for a lump sum Austrian payment of $150 million, $1.52 billion in today's money. Remaining details on a peace treaty were to be worked out by deputies with the aim of reaching agreement by September 1st. It would not come until 1955. On the most pressing issue, four-power decision-making in Berlin, discussions deadlocked. The Russians persisted in their demands for veto power in the city, saying it was needed to counteract hostility to the Soviet Union on the part of the Berlin authorities, a striking admission that the locals despised them. Moscow's stance, Acheson said, boils down to a statement that the four powers can do what they like in Berlin, so long as it is what the USSR wants. But the Allies preferred no deal to a new Soviet veto. Meanwhile, arguments over remaining trade blockages were heated. To keep control over Allied movements in eastern Germany, the Soviets refused entry of Western Zone train engineers and crews, demanding a switch at the border to their own trains and crews. They continued to block highway crossings, impose documentation requirements, ban Western-licensed publications, and prohibit exports from Berlin. To Allied protests, the Soviets retorted that more tonnage was now entering West Berlin than before the blockade. East Berlin, in contrast, was receiving nothing but a trickle, which proved that the Allies had not really lifted restrictions. A U.S. intelligence report said that the Soviet blockade was being raised largely because of bottlenecks in the Eastern Zone economy. The Soviets needed the Allied restrictions lifted. But once their problems were overcome, they would reimpose the blockade, provided Berlin has not entirely fallen by the autumn. Murphy, a member of the delegation in Paris, revived Clay's proposal for an armed convoy to challenge any new Soviet obstruction. Acheson wanted to treat a new Berlin crisis as close to an act of war. Truman said he would, in the event of a new blockade, back every possible means of action that would be costly to the Russians. To Acheson's surprised satisfaction, however, Vyshinsky accepted his proposal of a simple modus vivendi on Berlin, a broad agreement just to restore elements of East-West trade and not to reimpose blockages. The clincher came at a private dinner talk in which Acheson suggested that if the goods coming from the West into East Germany went beyond the Eastern Zone, that was not a matter which need cause us any difficulty. If the Soviets stole goods bound for East Germany, Washington would look the other way. Murphy and Jessup decried a lack of specifics on Western access rights in the city, but Acheson argued that efforts to define them might be worse than futile. If the United States put specific rights in a draft and then later agreed to their removal, the Soviets would interpret this agreement as renunciation. In any case, given that the blockade had obliterated the rail access the ACC had defined back in 1945, whether such rights were in writing meant little in practice. The Soviets never saw hard constraints in mere words. A dozen years later, Stalin's successor would divide Berlin with a wall, triggering a crisis that would again bring the two sides to the brink of war. At 7:30 p.m. on June 20th, hours after the meetings had concluded, Acheson was giving a press conference when Bolin slipped him a note. Vyshinsky wanted to recall the conference communique and reconvene. Acheson was astonished. Bevan, who had already fortified himself with scotch, met Acheson in the elevator back at the Quai d'Orsay. "Do you know the red flag?" the inexplicably jolly Englishman asked, referring to the old Labour Party anthem. "No," a bemused Acheson said. "He didn't." "Well, you know, Maryland, my Maryland." "Yes, I know that absolutely," Acheson said. "It is my native song now." "Well, it's the same tune," Bevan said. "So when we get out of the lift, you sing Maryland, my Maryland, and I'll sing the red flag." Acheson agreed. The two exited the elevator, arms around each other. They marched down the hall singing past a startled French diplomatic corps. As they entered the meeting room, the union man bellowed, "Raise the scarlet standard high," and the lawyer burst the tyrant's chain. Vyshinsky stared, dumbfounded. "Me and my pal," Bevan explained, "is singing the same tune." No response. Vyshinsky was in trouble, Acheson surmised. Schumann advisor Alexandra Parodi took the secretary aside. Gromyko, he said, had just savaged Vyshinsky over the phone for his blunders in the agreement on Austria. Called him a stupid fool and worse, according to French officials bugging the call. When the minister's meeting got underway, Vyshinsky explained that the communique had to be amended. He needed words affirming the right of Soviet-owned Austrian properties to export profits or other income. He wasn't sure what that meant, though he could get answers from Moscow. Vyshinsky was floundering badly, Acheson observed. After responding archly that this was the shortest-lived agreement the Soviets had made yet, the American played for time, knowing Bevan would soon have to depart for his train to Calais. When the tipsy foreign secretary rose and made his apologies, Acheson gestured resignedly. "Nothing more could be done now," he said to Vyshinsky. "The communique has to stand." Thus did the four-power conference, the sixth and final, end in farce. Acheson returned to Washington on the Independence, the president's aircraft, to be greeted by a buoyant Truman himself. Both saw the conference as a triumph. The State Department, Acheson recorded, had shown it could outwork any of them and knew its stuff better. And Acheson had not just commanded the effort, as was General Marshall's way. He had been in the trenches, monitoring enemy movements and devising tactical options before directing the assault. This was his department now, and he would inspire loyalty as a different type of leader. Soviet acceptance of the modus vivendi, Acheson argued, was Stalin's tacit abandonment of the position that the Allies had lost their rights in Berlin. There was no need of a larger agreement. The West could now go its own way. The Soviets had wanted a firm grip on East Germany and a free opening in the West, but our path in Germany must be pursued. Congress and the press embraced this narrative. On his departure from Berlin, following the ending of the blockade, General Clay was saluted by 11,000 U.S. soldiers and dozens of military aircraft, the largest military review the Army ever staged in Germany. Hailed in the Philadelphia Inquirer as the hero of the American resistance to Soviet siege and pressure, and the New York Times as the man who dared to face the showdown and who guided it through to its successful conclusion. He returned home to be honored by the President and Congress and paraded in New York. Declining solicitations to take command of the Japanese occupation from General MacArthur or run for political office, Clay retired from the Army. On his death 3 decades later in 1978, he would be buried in the Cadet Cemetery at West Point. At the foot of his grave, a marble stone from Berlin would be placed inscribed with the words, Wir danken dem Bewahrer unserer Freiheit. We thank the defender of our freedom. On June 5, 1949, the second anniversary of Marshall's Harvard speech, Truman, accompanied by a bevy of West European dignitaries, feted George Marshall as one of the greatest Americans of all time. Paul Hoffman called him a military genius who knew that freedom could not be maintained by bullets alone. It was, he said, through the Marshall Plan that the general will live forever in the hearts of free men. We are winning the Cold War through ECA and the North Atlantic Pact, Arthur Vandenberg said. In my opinion, if it were not for these policies, Soviet communism would today be in the substantial control of Europe, and this would pose the greatest threat to our own national security in the lifetime of the Republic. In 1953, Marshall would, in recognition of his efforts to promote European recovery and in spite of East-West conflict spilling into the Asia-Pacific, receive the Nobel Peace Prize. On August 14, 1949, in a historic event Stalin had been determined to prevent, Adenauer's CDU-CSU center-right coalition narrowly outpolled Schumacher's SPD in West Germany's first popular election. Well short of a majority in the new Bundestag, Adenauer refused to accept a grand coalition, thinking it dangerous for both democracy and capitalism in the fledgling state. Determined not to concede the economics ministry to a socialist, he negotiated a coalition with the free market FDP, Free Democratic Party, and the small agrarian DP, German Party. A month later, on September 15th, he was elected federal chancellor by the barest majority of 202-200 in the Bundestag, naming free marketeer Ludwig Erhard Minister of Economic Affairs, and the FDP's Franz Blücher, Minister for Matters of the Marshall Plan. The now 73-year-old leader said his doctor had declared him fit to govern for at least a year, perhaps two. He would serve for 14 years. Still legally subservient to the supreme authority of the Western occupying powers, Adenauer and his top ministers were summoned to receive the occupation statute from the American, British, and French High Commissioners on September 21st. Spotlighting their preeminence, the three made their way onto a red carpet. They directed the chancellor-elect to remain just beyond it until André-François Poncet, the French chairman, had proclaimed the statute's entry into force. Adenauer, who considered the ceremony a disagreeable rite of passage for his new government, made a show of displeasure by stepping onto the forbidden surface before the proclamation's reading. Pained smiles greeted the act of defiance, a sign that the chancellor would assert his country's democratic legitimacy. Yet the three need not have worried. Adenauer was committed to Franco-German rapprochement, and cementing the Federal Republic of Germany's place in the emerging Western alliance. His vision for West Germany was consistent with that embodied in the Marshall Plan, which the country joined through the OEEC. But this conformity also provoked Schumacher to denounce Adenauer as the Chancellor of the Allies. While McCloy, the new American High Commissioner, worried about Adenauer's age and dictatorial tendencies, he also feared Schumacher's sensitivity and excitability. Acheson tried to reassure Schumacher and to contain his nationalist impulse by stressing that prospects for Germany were vastly better than what they were after World War I. This fact owed to the new attitude of the USA to help Europe politically and financially, and the great change in French sentiment and the willingness of France to cooperate with Germany. The Soviet government, for its part, heaped scorn on the new marionette state. It had been formed in violation of Potsdam to act as an obedient tool of the Western occupation powers for the realization of their aggressive plans in Europe. Though the 330-member SED-dominated Volksrat, People's Council in the Soviet zone, had adopted its own constitution a year prior, Stalin refrained from authorizing an East German state as long as he could. He hoped the blockade would stop the Allies from dividing the country. That aim, now thwarted, the Volksrat proclaimed the birth of the German Democratic Republic, GDR, on October 7th, creating Volkshammer, People's Chamber, and Landeskammer, Chamber of the States, to substitute for democracy by choosing the government's leaders. On October 11th, the two chambers unanimously elected longtime communist stalwart Wilhelm Pieck to the GDR presidency. The following day, former Social Democrat Otto Grotewohl became prime minister after he, together with his proposed cabinet and policy statement, received unanimous votes of confidence from the Volkshammer. True power, however, continued to be held by Grotewohl's deputy, Walter Ulbricht. Ulbricht followed Stalin's model, seizing power over the state through the party and not the government. Lacking charm or oratory skills, he was content to control the SED apparatus. In 1946, he had let Pieck and Grotewohl risk their necks in elections, wisely avoiding their public disgrace. Only one opinion, Ulbricht knew, counted. Stalin's. Married to Zhukov's former secretary and speaking fluent Russian, Ulbricht would have three audiences with the Vosges in Moscow in 1949-50, before the SED elected him to the post created for him, Secretary General. Beyond political domination of East Germany through Ulbricht, Moscow retained legal and economic control through the corporations it had created and the GDR's National Manifesto commitment to discharging reparations claims. Another year would pass before the country would hold its first communist-style public elections, when the SED-controlled National Front list would garner 99.7% of the vote. Following Pieck's and Grotewohl's elections, Stalin sent a letter of congratulations, adding that the German and Soviet peoples together possessed the greatest potential in Europe for the accomplishment of great acts of world significance. It was further evidence the U.S. chargé in Moscow, Wally Barber, cabled Acheson, of the Kremlin's undeviating view that Germany is key to the control and Bolshevization of Europe. The Allied High Commission pronounced the GDR devoid of any legal basis. New arenas of confrontation between the Soviet Union and the United States would soon open up around the globe. Stalin had broken the U.S. nuclear monopoly with a test blast on August 29, 1949. 3 years sooner than most American experts had expected. Future conflicts now threatened to destroy the planet, yet the world, George Orwell wrote with dark optimism, was probably not headed for imminent annihilation, but rather an epoch as horribly stable as the slave empires of antiquity. The atomic bomb, he said, had rendered the two hegemons at once unconquerable and in a permanent state of cold war with their neighbors. Indeed, the boundaries of the conflict in Europe were now set. They would remain so for 40 years. 13. Success According to legend, the 11th century Islamic poet Muhammad ibn Ammar successfully defended the kingdom of Seville against the formidable Christian king Alfonso VI of Leon and Castile. He did so not on the battlefield, but in a game of chess. Whether or not historical fact, the story foreshadows the advent of modern diplomacy, or the idea that nonviolent competition might determine the control of territory and resources. Though a revolutionary, Joseph Stalin saw himself as an heir to a noble Russian tradition of imperialist statecraft. He had supreme regard for the potentialities of brute force, yet took pride in his image as a diplomatic virtuoso who could change the course of events through guile and bluff. Chess books have reproduced a 1926 match in which he allegedly bested future NKVD chief Nikolai Yezhov. The match was clearly fabricated, possibly to show him as a man of strategic vision. Never a serious player himself, Stalin still supported the game and its Soviet grandmasters as a means of highlighting Soviet intellectual superiority. George Kennan was also a chess player of no particular note, one who saw himself engaged in a match against the Soviet leader. The doctrine of containment he propounded in 1947 was in fact developed with the image of chess in mind. Since the Russian threat is more than a military threat, Kennan said at a War College lecture in October 1947, it could not be effectively met entirely by military means. It meant marshaling all the forces at your disposal on the world chessboard in such a way that the Russian sees it is in his interests to do what you want him to do. The Marshall Plan was the centerpiece of Kennan's thinking. Victory would be defined as the revival of a democratic, capitalist Western Europe without military confrontation. Using economic assistance as a vehicle, Kennan intended the Marshall Plan to change the psychology of the beneficiaries. It would convince them that they could regain prosperity and security without resorting to autarky or authoritarianism. It would, Kennan calculated, accomplish this feat partly by forcing Russia to set itself against such assistance and thereby undermine the standing of communism. In chess, such a move is known as a sham sacrifice, appearing to blunder into loss of a piece to gain tactical advantage. Unlike Kennan, Benjamin Franklin was an accomplished chess player, one who conducted consequential diplomacy during actual games in Europe. In his essay On the Morals of Chess, published in 1786, he wrote that the game required foresight, seeing the long-term consequences of action, circumspection, surveying the landscape and recognizing hidden possibilities, caution, avoiding haste or blunder, and perseverance, continually looking to improve one's position. So success with the Marshall Plan would require the United States to exhibit such capacity over many years. It would mean making, in chess terms, controversial real sacrifices, such as the loss of Poland and Czechoslovakia to the Soviet bloc, to strengthen America's long-term position in the West. Though the Presbyterian moralist side of Kennan anguished over the loss of these noble nations, the Bismarckian side argued as early as 1944 that a successful American endgame would require conceding pawns in the East early on. He predicted the Prague coup 4 months before Stalin instigated it, advising no preventive countermeasures. To Harriman's contention that Washington could not accept that the Soviet Union has the right to penetrate her immediate neighbors for security, Kennan responded that it was not realistic to expect Moscow to concede its security belt, given the price it had paid during the war. There was no use in giving Stalin pretext to challenge America's own Monroe prerogatives in the Western Hemisphere. The object must therefore be to establish the line beyond which we cannot afford to permit the Russians to exercise unchallenged power, and to be friendly but firm in laying it down. That line was drawn with the Marshall Plan. It was consistent with Kennan's argument made in a letter to Bolin at Yalta in 1945, that the United States needed to divide Europe frankly into spheres of influence, to keep ourselves out of the Russian sphere and keep the Russians out of ours. But this division did not mean conceding permanence. It meant waiting patiently for Moscow's defenses to crumble. By 1947, Dean Acheson and Will Clayton considered the FDR vision of a post-war recovery underpinned by UN, IMF, and World Bank action thoroughly discredited. The executive branch, they concluded, would have to eat practically every word it had uttered before congressional committees during the past 3 years. The Marshall Plan took a different approach, aiming to generate a rapid and robust European recovery through unilateral U.S. economic intervention. By any reasonable standard, such a recovery did occur. Between 1947 and mid-1952, when Marshall Aid officially ended, industrial output in the Marshall countries increased by 60%. By way of comparison, the EU-27 Industrial Output Index increased by 15% between January 2003 and January 2008, the years preceding the financial crisis. There were wide variations. Growth ranged from 24% in Sweden to 241% in West Germany. But gains were generally significant and widespread. To what extent, however, was recovery driven by the Marshall Plan itself? Aid may improve a country's standard of living while it is being consumed without improving the country's ability to provide for itself. So what we should ask is whether West European economies actually performed better than they otherwise would have in the absence of Marshall Aid. It is useful first to consider the situation Marshall planners inherited. In 1945, industrial production was a mere 34-46% of pre-war levels in the Netherlands and France, and 20% in Germany and Italy. Only a small portion of the collapse, however, was attributable to bombing displacement of production facilities. Most of it related to an inability to move raw materials, food, and goods. Damage to transport infrastructure, roads, bridges, rail, and ports was immense. As such, infrastructure underwent repair from mid-1945 to late 1946, recovery was strong. The bitter winter of 1946-47 and the subsequent horrendous harvests dealt Europe a setback. Shortages of food, fuel, and industrial materials reverberated throughout the production chain. This setback was temporary, however. Industrial and agricultural production picked up again by late 1947 and carried over into 1948, when Marshall funding began. Between 1948 and 1952, 4.25 years, the United States transferred $13.2 billion to the 16 Marshall Plan countries. Accounting for inflation over those years, the total was $14.3 billion, that is, in 1952 dollars. The aid was front-loaded, with 31% coming in 1948, 30% in 1949, 20% in 1950, 12% in 1951, and 8% in 1952. The largest recipients were the UK, $3.2 billion, or $32 billion today, France, $2.7 billion, or $27 billion today, Italy, $1.5 billion or $15 billion today, and West Germany, $1.4 billion or $14 billion today. Austria and Norway were the biggest beneficiaries per capita, $130 or $1,300 today. The transfers equaled, on average, 2.6% of recipient country output over the period. In today's dollars, total Marshall Aid was worth $130 billion. But if the United States had run a Marshall Plan of equivalent size as a proportion of GDP, 1.1%, from 2012 to 2016, this would have amounted to a vastly higher $800 billion. The total aid figure is higher still if we account for non-Marshall military and other assistance. Given that recovery was underway in Europe when Marshall Aid started flowing, however, it is challenging to estimate its effects. We know that growth was generally higher in those countries that received more aid, as a percentage of GNP. But to isolate the specific impact of aid on growth, economists have run statistical simulations using historical data, comparing actual growth rates after 1948 with what might have been expected in its absence. The most widely cited estimates suggest that Marshall Aid did have a significant positive effect. That is, even after controlling for other factors that might have contributed. In France, Germany, Denmark, and the Netherlands, output growth in 1948 through 49, attributable to the Marshall Plan, appears to have been a full 2 to 5 percentage points higher than it would have been in its absence. In Austria, it was 7 percentage points higher. These growth rates represent remarkable rates of return on U.S. aid, 100% or more. How might the Marshall Plan have accomplished this, if indeed it did? The primary analyses underlying the congressional case for Marshall Aid, such as that carried out by Bissell for the Harriman Report, contended that Europe was experiencing a shortage of working capital that was holding back recovery. They argued that if the dollar gap could be closed, local capital could be liberated for reconstruction. The simulations examined three possible Keynesian channels through which this might, in the end, have happened. One was higher investment, under the logic that the aid supplemented deficient savings in Europe. Broadly, the evidence supports the argument that Marshall Aid did stimulate investment, and that such investment boosted growth. But given that the aid amounted to only 2.6% of recipient output, on average, increased investment would only account for about 0.5 percentage point of growth. Such growth is not insignificant, but hardly enough to justify the plan's legendary status. Another possibility is that the aid reduced constraints on critical non-investment components of government spending, spending for which private capital could not have been mobilized. This seems plausible, given that war damage was enormous and that European governments were limited in their ability to finance repairs while meeting immediate social needs. Budget deficits in 1946 were huge, around 10% of national income in the UK, France, Italy, and Belgium. Yet by the end of that year, nearly 6 months before Marshall's Harvard speech, the worst of the damage holding back production, damage to electricity and transport, had been repaired, and industrial output, save in Germany, had returned to 1938 levels. Furthermore, recipient government spending as a share of national income actually declined on average during the Marshall years. This fact is consistent with State Department pressure for market-led growth and contrary to GOP fears of Marshall Aid financing socialism. There is, further, no evidence that such spending had a significant impact on growth. In short, the Marshall Plan did not aid recovery by boosting government spending. A third possibility is that the aid removed constraints on the ability to import. European countries ended the war with meager reserves of dollars and gold, which were by then the only internationally accepted forms of money. Against the background of the 1930s, when two-thirds of U.S.-held foreign securities issued in the 1920s went into default, private lending from the United States was not an option this time around. Current account deficits, which were large in Germany, France, the Netherlands, and Austria, could only be sustained with foreign aid. The Marshall Plan provided this. But how important was the aid? The evidence shows that Marshall countries were able to run larger current account deficits, but the effect is modest, roughly 12 cents larger for each dollar of Marshall aid. This could still be important, however, if the imported materials were bottlenecks for other processes, such as steel production. Coal was one such critical import. Without it, Marshall country output might have been as much as 3% lower. Such estimates may overstate the importance of foreign exchange in the Marshall Plan, however. We know, for example, that recipients abjured currency devaluation until 1948-49. Even Keynes had opposed it in Britain, and that this tool was successful in boosting dollar reserves. It could therefore have assisted more if it had been undertaken earlier. Economists such as Gottfried Haberler, Jakob Wiener, Fritz Machlup, Friedrich Lutz, and Henry Hazlitt made this argument at the time. Yet American ambivalence about devaluations, driven by traditional concerns not to undermine U.S. trade competitiveness, contributed to delaying these necessary steps. Altogether, then, the Keynesian stimulus lens for explaining the apparent economic success of the Marshall Plan is not very useful. Kindleberger, among the more prominent Keynesian implementers of the Marshall Plan at State, became much more circumspect toward the approach in later decades, and would not have been surprised by these results. The first use of Keynesian analysis in a major governmental document that I recall is that of the Harriman Report, largely drafted by Richard Bissell, he wrote in 1984. It was a brilliant use of the links running from investment to national income, both for short-run business cycle analysis and for growth. Yet Kindleberger ultimately dealt a low grade to a Keynesian point of view, at least in explaining the problems of Italy, a major Marshall beneficiary with which he worked. He ultimately concluded that its unemployment problems were structural, from wrong factor productions, and not cyclical, from lack of demand, as American Economic Cooperation Administration economists held. It is important to recognize, however, that the Marshall Plan's most important early architects and advocates never put their faith in narrow stimulus channels. Such faith came only later, with the arrival of Bissell and the ECA planners. Indeed, the whole exercise of trying to isolate the impact of resource transfers from the United States to explain Europe's recovery is to misapprehend the plan's motivations. The funds themselves were not originally intended to be more than a pump primer. The plan's architects, Kennan and Clayton in particular, believed that a multi-year program of assistance was necessary to establish confidence in a long-term American commitment to European recovery and security, to reduce political and social resistance to vital structural policy reforms, and to ease the reintegration of Germany into Europe's economic architecture. Kennan had argued from the outset that Europe's problems were psychological, and that the primary stimulative effect of the Marshall Plan would come from beneficiaries seeing that the United States was committed to helping restore them as free and independent nations. Even in Kennan's earliest formulations, immediate aid, to alleviate hardship and remove production bottlenecks, was intended only to gain time to deal with the long-term problem of establishing confidence, cooperation, and reform. It meant, as Acheson said in Senate testimony in 1949, that sickness could be better cared for, the aged were no longer neglected, there were textbooks for the schools, teachers and judges no longer needed to live meanly on the edge of despair, cities could be kept clean again, and transportation and utilities systems could supply the needs of people in carrying on their daily work. For his part, Clayton argued that, even in the short run, recovery would still have to be driven by structural policy change. On his return from Europe in May 1947, he drew attention to the breakdown in the European division of labor, both within and across countries, occasioned by the war, and the role that national policies were playing in exacerbating the problem. Food shortages in France had been created by government-imposed price rollbacks and controls in a misguided attempt to prevent an inflationary spiral. Farmers hoarded food for themselves and their livestock rather than sell it in the cities, knowing that the proceeds would just get eaten up by soaring prices before they could find consumer goods, which were in short supply for the same reason. Marshall aid was itself insufficient to make up for food and goods not being produced or sold. Policy change was needed to allow prices of scarce goods to rise, thereby encouraging production. And whereas the policies on which the United States conditioned its aid were not always coherent, public finances and monetary policy shifted in a more prudent direction. Food prices in France and Italy, which had begun their steep rise well before the harsh winter of 1946-47, began declining sharply after announcement of the Marshall Plan. West European inflation in the early post-Marshall period, 1952-58, would fall to levels as low as they would be for the next 50 years. Marshall funds provided a buffer that may have helped market-friendly reforms take hold without being undermined by mass labor and social unrest. But to what extent were such reforms actually driven by Marshall funds? Would different policies have been pursued without them? These would be awkward questions for the American ECA planners who liked to maintain that their assistance in the design of European policies was just friendly, even as they privately cajoled and threatened to get the ones they wanted. American control of so-called counterpart funds